The next reader we have is Ramona Kitchen. She's a graduate from the University of Pittsburgh with 3 master's degrees. Wow, that's something else there. You gave me the answers. I couldn't have got one. She has been published in Main Street Rag, and I've seen that. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, I've seen that. Rural Literary Magazine, The Essence Magazine, The California Quarterly, 5 a.m., Mudfish, and many more. Her poetry lesson plan is just to include... Wow. See what happens when Joan's not around. The Austin House, The Working Post, 75 writing, exercise and poetry anthologies, editing the Scott Minor. Her published chapbooks include Hip Hop Warrior, which I've heard her read, The Immortals, The Heaven of Elephants, and her latest, The Red Cover Bridge, through Porting House Press. Currently, she is dividing her time between writing plays, seeking publication of a book of short stories, and seeking publication of a full-length book of poetry. That's all well and good. Okay. But the truth is, she's my friend. She's a great poet. And she got that, you know, when you hear something, I'd like, so you understand in boxing, it's like the punch that you never see coming, it knocks you out. Ramona Kitchen, come on out here and knock them out.
That's yours. Huh. Well, it's wonderful to be here, especially with Jay and with Joe and with Rick, because, you know, for me, it's almost like a sport, poetry. It's lots of fun, and so these are sort of like, you know, my playmates. We have a lot of fun doing poetry. It's exciting. It's different. And there's just a couple things I want to say, though, before I begin. I'm writing all this poetry. I'm doing all these different things and creating all these different things. One of the things I want to say is something that some people would say that I shouldn't say, but that's what I always say, is what I shouldn't say. I like saying what I shouldn't say. And one of the things that I want to say that I shouldn't say, but that I will defend my right to say, is that my experience of Alice School was that they seem to be so, progressive, and all the girls, you know, are wonderful. I'm not saying that they're not, but I'm saying that some of the things that happened to me there when I was teaching were things that I feel that Jan Beatty can witness shouldn't be happening to poets when we come out and we give love and caring to young poets and want to see them grow, that they shouldn't do that when you come there with the right intent. And if they actually want those girls to learn poetry, they need to let go and let them learn poetry. And they need not to aggress the poet when the poet comes in and gives time. At the point I went there as a black female trying to do something I thought was productive. And that productive thing was to bring poetry in and be African American. Again, I had to deal with people saying things that they shouldn't say to me as an African-American female or as a poet or as anything else. And then putting their heads up in the air and walking away. And, you know, I just feel that it's not exactly a good thing. Now, do I feel that's all of them? No, but I would say as a poet, when you walk in there, that you would need to know that. And I'm saying that firmly because some of you will be just like me. Oh, it's kids, it's writing, and you know, you get paid, and then you find out later. I want to tell you. What do you think, Jan? Did you like that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. The first poem was inspired by Walt Peterson. Last week, if you weren't here, we did a play. And the play was a screenplay that he wrote. And so this is dedicated to you, Walt, for letting me read that part of the play. It made me think. I've got the blues. I've got the blues to end all blues. A poem for Billie Holiday dedicated to Walt Peterson. Portrait of a gardenia drying in the rain. Black women die more than live. Press your palm into my while I am here. Imagine what it is to be indigo inside, unrepressed. Indigo is what it is to be a black woman, any woman, when the bills aren't paid, when the lover leaves and never said he would not come back, and the blackbird moans from dawn to dusk. From the cotton fields on up heartless roads to the north, the blackbird knows no song except the song given to it, the hatred and the dishonor there in each refrain, born in pain and hanging out in the dark midnight hours of it with that whiskey bottle by your side? What was life supposed to be instead of the pain it became anyway? What was my true name? At 18, I heard her song, but the pain was a contemplation. By 24, I knew the sorrow of the blackbird with no place to go, even though we wax having something all the time. All those dead lovers, the caskets lined up, all those times without anything but the word nigger as a reflection of who others who didn't give a damn about you think you are. Pain like a through and through all the time. I placed a white gardenia in my hair, a petal from it falling between my breast and lingering there like a lover's head. Turntable, a record spinning, gardenia perfume applied gently to my body. I sat and listened to black woman silk in a darkened room and heard that suffering beaten into me. I could not explain that suffering I knew was in the hearts of many black women, all those shot sons and daughters and dead dreams and pain desires hanging around. No one can know but a black throat that pain welling up like blue smoke and fire of the soul from so deep down inside. Summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich and your ma is good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up singing. And you'll spread your wings and you'll take to the sky. But till that morning, there isn't nothing gonna harm you with daddy and mommy standing by. Ooh, right now, what happened to me is one day I was sitting there, and for me as a poet, sometimes things come to me as imagery. And the way I write poetry is, for me, a spiritual pursuit. Some of it has to do with being African-American. Some of it has to do with just being a person. So many years ago, I started doing quilts, and I started doing artwork. And it just came to me in this way, this inflex, like God wanted me to do these quilts and things like that. And what I did recently is I thought about those quilts and I said, they're almost like a passageway to the rest of my creativity. And so I put it together in a book, and it's called Poems of the African American Improvisational Quilt. And what it is the quilt panels, I describe them in the book. And then what I do is I have poems that were inspired by the quilts. The quilts are appliqué, and by appliqué I mean that they actually depict certain scenes and certain things that happen. And when I do some of the quilts, sometimes I just start cutting, and then the images come to me, and then I start to fill those out as I go. And I started painting and doing everything. And, you know, that's just the way I do things. I just sort of like, it just sort of comes to me, and I do what I want to with it, and people like it, they like it. If they don't, well, you know, you try something else. So the quilt comes first, and then poems that go with it, and these are just some excerpts from the book. African-American Improvisational Quilt Number 1, The Cotton Fields. African Americans love America as if it were a wife given to them by God. They wash the feet of America. They pray for America when the dream of America goes away from them. They sow seeds and grow and plant for her to feed her and make her well. At night, when she has not come home, they sit in the darkness in a chair waiting for her, their Bible in their lap, hoping she has been faithful. Have you been faithful, America, with your beautiful slender waist and long, graceful feet? Even in the times of sharecropping and lynching, my family loved America and still loves America. They wanted to be her only husband, her one true love. Still, sometimes within that acceptance, there was rejection, the lonely hours, the time of retrospection after midnight. This poem was called We Must Always Realize God Protects Us All. In my mind, there have been dreams of a cotton field in Georgia. The rows span out further than eyes can see. There's a little girl in the cotton fields of Georgia. She is dark brown with a red and beige plaid worn dress on. She is innocent concerning those who think of her as a nigger, innocent of those who wish not to mix with her and those who would hold her back. The fields are wide, but she is tiny yet strong, and she sets off like a gazelle and runs to the rows. This is where she plays. This is where she grows. No money for true toys, no spelling books or fancy games. I see her running through many centuries. I see her running through forced labor, unfair wages, coal mines, factories, and steel mills to the graveyards. I see her enduring and still pressing forth towards God, still able and accepting of any love giving. Her hair is fuzzy but caught up in three braids. Her knees are ashen brown, but yet she is beautiful. Beautiful are the anointed of God. Beautiful are those who are held in servitude by the world, but protected by Him. May they always have the power to survive and prosper. This is African American Improvisational Quilt Number 2. I sat up late that night with coffee. There was happiness in my heart, but an understanding of my history, the history of my people and my family inside of me. If you study your family, you study life as a whole. To study family is to study love, stitch it panel by panel. I had been out that day in the central August and purchased material. I lay it out on a clean white table and began to cut, my hands aging but willing to tell the history of my beautiful childhood neighborhood, of a time of black men with jobs. I cut the forms and sang to myself about the Israelites and Moses, about a people freed from Egypt by God. But I knew that song I was singing for my people. Scissors and free hand cutting, I could see the images of my aunts, beautiful and strong. I heard their laughter, scented their sweet skin. I could see my grandmother and handsome uncles and cousins, all of them with that charisma that kept them in lovers all the days of their lives. I could hear the whistle from the steel mill, all those beautiful black men and handsome ethnic white men on their way home once more, no matter what the price paid in toil. And I think some of you could tell stories, if we had time, some of you could tell stories about your own families, some of them having worked in the steel mills, having worked in the coal mills, coal mines, and having done certain kinds of jobs here in Pittsburgh. It'd be very interesting to hear all the stories about that. This is for my grandfather. I have a step-grandfather and a grandfather. This one's for my step-grandfather. And we were taught as children, because he was not respected in society, to call him Mr. So I never knew either my grandfather or my step-grandfather's first name because we were taught to call him Mr. Martin, and my grandfather's name was Mr. Kitchens, and that was the way it was done. Mr. Martin. It's Sunday many years ago when we go to Denora, Pennsylvania, again to visit family. The roads wind up past where affluence dares not show its face. Then we are at grandmother's gray brick house. I enter, and for the first time in my life, I get to see my step-grandfather, Mr. Martin. He's in the living room, not as ill from the steel mills as he typically is. He's wearing overalls and smiling. Grandmother sits next to him and holds his hand. I hear the deception of the American work ethic rasping in his windpipes, all those tiny checks from the coins in a rich man's pocket rubbing together in blackened lungs. Grandmother beams. Children, Mr. Martin has a surprise for you. Don't be afraid. The doctor did a surgery, and Mr. Martin can talk again. Go ahead, sweetheart. Show them, she prompted gently. With all the strength left of him, Mr. Martin, songless bird, Mr. Martin, inheritor of unearned racial hatred, took a deep purple honey breath, the air moving through his throat after centuries of oppression, and said, I love all of you. Tears rolled down Grandmother's face. Tears rolled deep into the valley of the Nile. And aside from that is that when I used to walk down the streets in Wilkinsburg, at first they had the, the voice box. And there was one man who used to always joke with us, and I even wrote a poem about it. He used to stick a cigarette in there and smoke it. And we kids thought that was cool. We stand and go, ooh. This poem was called The Brokenhearted Quilt. Again, I'm saying things I shouldn't say, and, well, you know, I like that. The Brokenhearted Quilt is a story, and I think you'll get it as I go along. Beyond the trees and vines and darting birds, I feel I see God weeping after Adam broke his heart. Mankind can break your heart when they aren't trying, and most certainly if they are. 10 years ago, I started a heart quilt from scraps. I decided it was not good, and to pitch it out would make room for other things. The heart pitches and makes room for things all the time. My brother took the quilt out of the trash and sold it to an antique dealer as being made in 1910. He was such a motherfucker. I can still, you know, I'm emotional. I can still see myself going, you! Neighbors could hear and everything, and then I'd calm down. He'd say, calm down, Rebella. I'd say, I'm calm. You asshole! Okay, I'm done. I'm back. My brother took the quilt out of the trash and sold it to an antique dealer as being made in 1910 by an unknown person living in Topeka, Kansas. I imagined the lie to make a man give money for something made many months ago. I wept when I saw it on the cover of a magazine. I wept through all the hearts in it and a whole and how their material fragmented in me, tore and ripped. We can never truly apologize for the intentional wrong. It is a mutilation of fine fabric beyond repair with scissors. It is a dye bath too dark to weaken in the fibers of muslin again. And I apologize for the cursing. All right, and this is the brokenhearted quilt number two. Go to the funeral of a family member. Sit at the dinner table and eye them all. All those Africans removed that have forgotten what it is to be communal or loving and only have hatred in their souls. Here, pass the sweet peas on down, and there is warm bread over here. Clink of silverware, hot air, sweat hounding on your brow. Ain't nothing here but fake consternation, the masked thief, the hidden nemesis. Take the red eye out that night, your briefcase filled with copies of family photos they say you have to have, as if that is what family truly is. Pass the sweet potatoes and the salt of guilt. Bury the past when you believe in the purity of blood. And this is a fun poem. I have to add a fun poem because I like fun. Hey. This one, if you know the words of the song at the end of the poem, you can sing along with it. If you don't, if you think that's corny and you don't want to do that, well, I'm watching you. African-American nostalgic. If we can remember not only back into that which is sorrowful about our lives, but into that which is earnest and good, then we recreate what was correct about life in the first place. In my mind, it is many years ago, and I am a child in the kitchen with my mother. It is hot summer, air blows through a yellow sheer of kitchen curtain, and she's making dinner ham, sweet peas and carrots, and macaroni and cheese. She has the radio on, and Bill Bailey, "Won't You Please Come Home," comes on. Mother begins to laugh and say, "Oh, I used to love this song. Here, isn't it great?" She begins to dance around the kitchen. The music is happy and free, and she tells me, "Come on, act like you're singing." My brother comes in the kitchen playing an imaginary trombone, and then my sister gets up from her tiny table and does a hand jive, and we laugh and laugh. The song ends, and we children sadden. She says, "No, let's sing it ourselves and keep going." And we do for the rest of our lives. "Won't you come home, Bill Bailey? Won't you come home? I moan the whole night long. I'll do the cooking, honey. I'll pay the rent. I know you've done me wrong. You remember that rainy evening? I threw you out with nothing but a fine tooth comb. You know I'm to blame. Now isn't it a shame? Bill Bailey, won't you please come home?" Thank you. That was fun. We gotta have some fun, just a little bit of, and this is the last poem. Do I have enough time for one more, or is that it? I am a jazz fan, and this is for Kay, because she brought me a jazz magazine, one that I love. That's what I listen to, a lot of jazz, and I think that what they're doing to jazz in Pittsburgh, it sucks. I think what they're doing to prosody, it sucks. Okay. I'm done. All right. Jazz quote inception. Charles Mingus plays, and dawn cannot express itself anymore, can only play audience and listen. The world became a plane amongst many other planes, and there is no value to it which is not amply expressed via his notes and the between of his notes. Charles Mingus plays, and something about blackness and black men becomes infinite, becomes finite and definable and less unknown. It is raining in between the notes played and in between the notes of New York City, then morning becomes a dead, a harder resolution. The piece of life is highly skilled improvisation, flexible to beat but elusive to rhythm. Mingus, light, his daughter passing into being. The police come and evict Mingus, arrest his addiction. Furniture is dragged to a dumpster on the street. Belongers no longer belong, and are his stepchildren left to no demise but their own. His piano, where genius bore composed children, disappears, its truer destination unknown. Years later, he is dead, but celluloid lives to tell. Charles Mingus plays. There's a static like a snake hiss on the recording, static like the last lost sound before the revolution of unintended digression.
That's the end of the poems. I just have one thing to say before I'm done. And it's just that for me, at this point in our society, it used to be that if you were a poet or something, you had to be a drug addict or you had to do something really freaky and all that to be a poet. Now, as you see, a lot of us, I think you do, except for Jay with that sexy poetry. You live very, I like the poetry too, Jay, but you live very calm, you know, normal lives for the most part, with just a little kink or two in them. And I think that that's nice to see that, that it doesn't have to be that you have to, you know, slit your wrist and all that stuff like that, and, you know, to be creative. And I want to thank you for your time.